Oh, hey, Natalie.
Hey, Kristen.
We have a brand new podcast.
Which we're so excited about.
With our friend, Josh Radner.
Which you will love listening to, so it's such a treat that we get to offer this to you.
We also want to let you know that we are teaching Create in New York City.
Reunited.
And it feels so good. So it'll be this Sunday, November 18th at 7 p.m. at the Royal Family Performing Arts Center.
And this Create is very special. We are bringing you this Create by donation only. We want you there, whether you can pay a dollar or $5 or $20. We don't care. We want your butt in the seat.
So if you are around, you're in New York this Sunday, you want to come and get vibed up, we would love to see you.
We are teaching on It's Not a Hustle, It's a Game.
So come get in on the game. And now, without any further ado,
we welcome our dear friend and great spiritual master, actor, producer, writer, musician, Josh Radner. Enjoy, woo! Friends.
Oh,
here we are. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls.
Oh my goodness.
We have a special treat for you. And now, treat number one. Kristen looks very beautiful today.
I do?
Yes. Do you want me to tell everyone?
Yes, please.
Kristen is wearing a beautiful top, and when she showed up at my house wearing this top, I actually changed my top so I could compliment how beautiful she looked.
You always want to look good for something that's solely audio.
Yes.
You must.
You must.
Yeah.
It's, well,
you want to have a torso made for radio. Isn't 100%. That the phrase?
That's right. Torso made for radio.
Everyone says, yeah. I look gorgeous on radio. Yeah.
So then we had our special guest of the day show up, and I also must say, his outfit is very complimentary to our outfit, so I feel like all the right things are happening.
We're all coordinated. This is great.
We're all in a kind of blue,
yeah.
As is the room.
And I yes, feel my like wall is also painted blue. For those of you who've been listening.
Oh, that wall. Yeah, yeah,
this
yeah.
wall is painted blue. I cried about it. I told the story about crying about
see,
it.
See, I like the blue, but that's that masculine thing that you had a hard time relinquishing control over. Is that right?
You know, I'm living my best life.
Yeah. Which is why she cried when the wall got painted.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, we want to tell you about our very, very, very special guest here today. This person is very profound and very special and very smart and very cute and very a lot of things. And as I'm saying all these things, he's like hiding in his corner.
Are you blushing?
No.
You're
no.
Totally blushing.
I'm not blushing. There's a lot of lemon in the water. Maybe pucker up.
You're pretty cute when you blush. Saying that, Josh Radner.
We also put Josh Radner between us so he has no escape.
Oh, is this not normally?
Kristen on one side,
do?
Natalie on the other.
Okay.
He's stuck.
Is this like a little angel devil situation? I have to figure out which is
who. That's who?
I'll know. We'll know soon. We'll know soon enough. Yeah.
So Josh is, as many of you probably know him, as a phenomenal actor, writer, producer, and overall amazing human being. And we're so happy that Josh, you've joined us on the Create podcast today.
And can we also say musician?
Hey now.
I'm a big fan of Josh's music and got the opportunity to see him perform at the Troubadour.
Oh, yeah. That was a great show.
Yeah. That was the one show that... No, I'm just teasing.
That you missed.
You've
seen all the other ones, yeah.
I'm the stalker usually.
Yeah, yeah, we got to play at the Troubadour, which is like this great story venue in LA.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a few months ago, Josh and I had breakfast in Los Angeles, and as he was talking and sharing a bit of his story, I felt floored because I felt like so much of what you were talking about when you were sharing your spiritual journey, how you came to ask questions about the deeper things of life.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, well, I feel like the people who listen to our podcast would be so enriched by hearing your story.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Great. So Josh, give us a little story of your life, a little version of whatever it is for you that you feel like sharing with our audience, with our listeners, who are creators and artists, people who are at different phases of their creative journey or their artistic journey. Give us for you how you came to be where you are today and what that process has been like for you.
Yeah. Hi, listeners of this podcast, first of all. Thank you guys for having me on here, or in here and with you. When I was at NYU, our teacher, Ron Van Loo, he studied with Olympia Dukakis, and she said something to them. She said, the reasons you become an actor are not the reasons you're going to stay an actor. And I thought that was really interesting to chew on, because I think, like, the reasons I became an actor, or the reason anyone maybe, finds their way to performance is, well, I can't generalize. Let me just speak for myself. It felt very much like, my favorite part of, this is embarrassing to admit, but like my favorite part of performing when I started was curtain calls. Mm-hmm. Because like I wanted people to honor me and see me and cheer for me. And now I kind of hate curtain calls. Like, it's weird. Like I just am like, they're my least interesting part of it, you know, for me. But I feel like I was playing out certain wounds as a kid, that like certain needs that maybe weren't met. And I'm not even putting this at my parents' feet. I just mean in whatever way we're raised. And I found this thing that I thought I might be excellent at this thing, or I could possibly be excellent at this thing. And I worked and worked and worked. And then it transferred into a almost more like a healthier expression. But that said, when I started getting successful in a way that was more notable or visible, I found that it plunged me into this existential crisis of like, this can't be what I'm actually looking for, because all the things I thought that fame and celebrity and success would take away from, I actually felt an increase in the very things that I thought were going to be taken away. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. My insecurity skyrocketed, mm-hmm. my neuroses skyrocketed, my catastrophic thinking skyrocketed. Like, it didn't take anything away. So then it just plunged me on this journey that was like, wait a minute. Okay, so money, success, fame, access, all these things like don't take away the God-shaped hole. Like, they just don't. It's not a money-shaped hole. It's not a success-shaped hole. Like, it's appropriately named. So, and when I say God, like, I just want to be clear that I'm not talking about some gray bearded thing. I'm talking about like the ground of being, yes. Foundational kind of the hum of truth, whatever that is, like why we're here.
We talk about that a lot in our podcast. You can call it whatever you want.
Yeah, but I think it's important for people to at least know that that word, we have so much PTSD around that mm-hmm. word, that it's like, I wish there was a better word for it. Yeah, you know, you can dance around it, but ultimately, like, it's the only word I have that kind of is big enough. Actually, did you read Michael Pollan's book on psychedelics?
I haven't yet. I'm dying to read
awesome.
That book.
But it's a very interesting thing where this, it's about these, partly about these psilocybin experiments they've been giving to terminally ill cancer patients like at Johns Hopkins and NYU and UCLA. And this woman who was like an absolute atheist, she said, I felt like I was held in the arms of God, like almost the whole time. And they said, but you're an atheist. And are you no longer an atheist? She said, no, I'm still an atheist. It's just the only language I have for it. Like, it's the only language big enough to describe what I was feeling, you know? So I'm speaking about something like much more ineffable. And I still have had to unwind the kind of punishing God archetype in my head. It's like literally like a game operation, like literally like pointillist, like neurosurgery, like getting that, the remnants of that thing out of my head, my psyche.
I heard Anne Lamont the other day say that she calls it Phil. She's like, God was just too low of a term. So
oh, P-H-I-L. Yeah. So, I don't know. It just, I'm really grateful for the despair that it plunged me into, or at least the haunted feeling that there had to be more, you know? So I just got really interested in, when I was on How I Met Your Mother, I like took my summers and I was like going down to Peru and drinking ayahuasca with shamans and doing meditation seminars. Like, I didn't have my foot so much on the accelerator of like actor. I was more like, I gotta do something. I gotta figure out what. And then I turned myself into a writer director, which was its own kind of spiritual journey. But ultimately, I think that acting, it didn't give me everything I was looking for. And I had worshipped it. Like, the cathedral, the empty theater was my cathedral for years. Like, that was where I got my spiritual juice. And it ultimately, like, its shoulders weren't big enough.
Yes.
You know?
Something that you said to me that really hit me was, you said, I was number one on the number one show, and that was, seeing that wasn't enough.
Yeah.
Made me go, well, then there's something else.
And it's probably not, like, I know a lot of miserable Academy Award winners.
Yes.
Like, I still think, like, well, maybe if I had an Oscar,
right,
I'd be
right.
happy. Like, maybe that would do it. But, like, I know some miserable, you know, awards-laden people.
Yeah.
They're just, none of that stuff's going to save you. Like, it just won't save you, I don't think.
Well, it's so interesting because we talk all the time at length, and almost I'm sure some people on the podcast are maybe even sick of hearing us talking about it, that it's an inner game. It's an inner game. It's an inner game. And the more you chase the form,
yeah.
the outer world, the bigger house, the bigger paycheck, the credits on the resume, the better agent, the whatever, we all think this is the thing that's going to fill the hole.
Yeah.
And ultimately, it's a gift and a curse to have the hole filled by those things, because then you realize it's not filled, and then you can move on
right.
to what ultimately
I always think this is a fairly dark example, but I always think about Philip Seymour Hoffman mm. as the person who had literally the greatest career you could ever imagine in the art, in show business. He had an off-Broadway theater that he directed at and staged plays, and all his friends got to work at, and he got to promote playwrights, so he had this funky off-Broadway thing. He starred in Death of a Salesman on Broadway. He had this Broadway Mike Nichols directed, like the greatest thing, and he had this unbelievable indie film career, and he got to be in huge movies, and he had three kids, and he had a partner, and heroin took him out. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
like that wasn't, it didn't it's inoculate him
mm.
against that demon or that despair. So I think sometimes, like, it's not, and I have to, it's a daily practice, because the illusion that that stuff will save you is so thick in our society.
Yes.
And it's like every advertisement, everything, you know, the way they edit things together to look, you know. And then when you really get the, like, true behind the scenes stuff, I'm reading this great book called Meet Me in the Bathroom about the music scene in New York from, like, 2001 to 2011. It's like the Strokes and the Yeah, Yeah, Yeahs and Interpol and the Killers and White Stripes and, you know, all these people were just like, all on drugs, and they were all underwater, and they didn't know what was going on, and they're all like now like what was that? You know, even though it was like kind of fun, but they were all terrified.
Yeah.
So it's like it's hard to even enjoy success while it's happening. That's why when you see someone like Bryan Cranston, where it happens a little later, they look like they know how to appreciate it a little
mm-hmm.
bit more. You know what I mean? They're just like, but he's still going to go home to his wife at the end of the day.
That's
you
right.
know? And that's what he's been doing for hour long. So.
Right. Actually, it's interesting you bring up Bryan Cranston, because he's producing Dangerous Book for Boys for Amazon now. And I actually got to sit in on their reading where they were presenting it to Amazon, trying to basically be
oh, wow.
picked up and presented as a show. And the thing that inspired me the most is you see this guy who's this profound actor on Breaking Bad, obviously feeling like the top echelon of his
yeah.
craft. And he showed up at this reading making sure everyone had a water bottle
yeah.
and
yeah.
so conscious and worried that everyone was going to be okay, because he cared so deeply about the content of the show
yeah.
and the content of what was getting created. He believed in so much that it was so much more important than any kind of celebrity. And it was almost the feeling that he knew his celebrity was bringing Amazon to the table.
Right.
And so he's willing to say, thank you, grateful, grateful.
Yeah.
But what we are creating is so much more important than the creator of it.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things I loved about this Uncle Vanya that I just saw is the way Richard Nelson directed it. It was almost like they actually taped it for PBS, but like these performances would all work on film. It was just really, you had to lean in for it, and it just restored like Chekhov to the star. Like it was about the masterfulness of the play, you know, rather than like, ooh, that showy performance. Like, it was a real ensemble. That's so beautiful to see when you see something like that. But, I know Bryan a little bit just from How I Met Your Mother, and we'll grab a meal every once in a while, and I really like him as a older example of, I'm always looking like, how do you age well in this business? Like, how do you not turn into like a craven, needy, you know, person who just makes everything about them? And how do you get that level of generosity and that level of gratitude just as a kind of baseline hum in your life all the time? Judith Light has that.
Oh, yes.
You know, she's a dear friend and a total example in that regard. But I always loved when older actors would come through on How I Met Your Mother, or even the show Mercy Street that I did. I got to spend time with all these, you know, actors, like, you know, a couple steps ahead of me, and it was such a joy, you know.
what for you, when you describe that time, you know, being on this show, being in the thick of it, what for
you... On How I Met Your Mother, you mean?
Yeah. What for you, if anything, was the true moments of understanding of, wow, you know, I have everything I want, but there's something missing. Were there certain catalyst moments, or was it an overall feeling tone that something was missing? What was kind of the catalyst
for
you?
Well, it's weird. There were days that were really hard on that set, and there were days that I was like, I'm the luckiest person in the world. So if you spend nearly a decade doing something, you're going to have every version of a day. You know, you bring yourself to the work. So we saw each other at our best, we saw each other at our worst. I think that something that when people ask about that show, like I do a lot of college speaking, and I spoke at Union College the other night, and, you know, they're asking about moments, and everyone wants to know if we're still friends. And I'm like, I really want to remind people that, like, it's not five people, it's 100 people. Like, it's 100 people. There's 25 people in the production office and writer's room, and there's 75 people on set surrounding you at all times. So when I think of How I Met Your Mother, I think of Pam Fryman, our director. I think of Lona and Jen and hair and makeup and Grace and Dave and props. And you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, Janet, script supervisor. Like, it's a set. It's a functioning ecosystem. It's a village. So there's a lot of people that, you know, you end up knowing their family. You have deaths. We had births. We had, like, life, real life happened. So I'm moved when I think about the community of people, you know, and what we did. But I'm also I think it was so jarring and vertigo inducing to become known, but then you kind of are like, I'm not becoming known in the right way, or people don't like me in the way I want them to like me, or they don't like me, or you just need to get used to people hating you. It's so weird. Like, if you, the first time you Google yourself, which I did once, you know, and then I was done. But, like, you see that there are people saying mean things about you. And the weird thing is, like, that's actually a sign that your career is going in a good direction, is if people are online saying crap about you, that means you're visible enough that they're saying crap about you.
Yeah.
And it feels to me, I think I sent you that India talk I gave.
Yes.
Like using celebrity as a spiritual practice, it's what Ram Dass talks about. Like, whatever is in your life in front of you is your yoga. Like, for him, it's his stroke, you know? For me, it was, like, being on this hit TV show for 9 years. I know it sounds like mine's better than his, but not to Ram Dass, it's not.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? He'd be like, no, it's just perfectly, the course curriculum is perfectly designed for you, and it's perfectly designed for me. So I just started to use it as, I found it so weird. I became, like, famous on this thing that was perpetually humbling to me.
Yeah.
Like, I never walked through dinner room and I was like, what's up, TV star here. I was always like, I'm playing a vulnerable guy on TV who has feelings. That's weird. Don't be mad at me, you know? And some people didn't want to see that. I had dinner with Carter and Craig, the creators of the show, and we were talking about, like, my character's aging quite well, like, after all these years, because I feel like he was revolutionary in certain ways, that he was really carrying a kind of open-hearted masculinity, you know, into the culture that is frowned upon. And, you know, Neil's character got to be, like, this kind of parody of hyper-masculinity. But the last year has been about, like, no, we're not going to put up with that guy anymore. Like, the hyper-masculine guy. Or just the kind of predatory jerk. And I can feel, like, oh, my God, how time alters things. Like, I really don't hear from people who hated my character anymore. And I used to hear from people when the show was on. And I feel like he's just kind of aged into someone people really care about and respect. And I'm grateful for that. You know, it's also interesting how art gets reappraised. Like, there's this article that I just read, an interview with Diablo Cody. And after she did Juno, she did this movie, Jennifer's Body. Mm-hmm. That was, like, this Megan Fox, you know, a movie that was mismarketed and mishandled, and the critics killed it. But there's been this reappraisal in the last decade, because it's kind of like a Me Too movie before the Me Too movement, you know. It was, like, really ahead of its time, and there's all this new critical reassessment of that movie. And you know, I love both movies I made, and they were also, like, kind of, with the first one especially, they were really beat up critically, even though they were, like, winning audience awards and stuff. And I got this different relationship to criticism, where I was like, oh, that's, like, really a rough draft. That really doesn't mean anything other than it's a bummer because it can keep people away from your movie who otherwise you'd love to see it. But I just started, you know, Liberal Arts, the second movie I directed, I also feel like that's aging quite well in a lot of ways, you know, content-wise. So I guess, like, being in it for the long haul rather than at a certain point, I think, you know, when I did Rise last year, this show, it was like, I really felt like a bit more of a veteran, like, because I was working with kids, and it was, like, their first TV show, so I was, like, the one they were looking to. I was like, oh, I'm the one with the most hours of, I mean, not Rosie Perez, she had more than me, but, you know, it was, it's interesting when you make that transition into, like, being more of a veteran than a wide-eyed newcomer, and I prefer it, you know.
Well, I think what you were saying about criticism, getting to that place, especially as a writer-director, so it's no longer, I'm just, there's a certain kind of vulnerability that occurs when you've made the thing, you've written the words, and you've been the one to direct it,
yeah.
And now it's out into the world, and being able to develop that, I want to say, it's not even just thick skin, but it doesn't matter what people say.
Right.
I mean, it does matter, and yet we know we're not going to stop creating because of the response of the world. In fact, we have to learn how my job is to create and trust that it will get to the people it's supposed to get to.
Absolutely. It's interesting with filmed entertainment because it tends to have a, like, real life. But, you know, Wicked was, like, demolished when it came. Like, no one, critics were a fan of that. Yeah. And everyone in the public was like, we love this. Yeah. Screw you. So,
still making money.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, it's an interesting thing to kind of be like, I'm going to keep making stuff. You know, like, really declare that to the universe. Like, hey, I'm just going to keep making stuff. And some of this is really going to hit and some of this is not. It's been an interesting thing. Like, I really have an ego wrestling thing going on because my tastes are quite niche in certain ways. Like, the things I really love are the things that not a lot of people know about. And I feel that I've been on this big hit TV show. Therefore, I feel like there's some sort of expectation that I'm supposed to keep doing big hit TV shows or big movies, but they're not, it's not actually my taste. Don't tell my agents this, but you know what I mean? Like, I'm much more attracted to, like, little obscure things. Like, I love scooping new bands and I love telling people to see that movie or the TV show that no one knows about. And it's not like I want to, like, die as a, you know, cult hero or anything. I'd love people to see what I do, but I also, you know, certain things, certain people only will know about something if it's a huge hit. So, like, I've done two series since I left How I Met Your Mother. I did a Broadway play. I did a play at Lincoln Center. I turned myself into a musician. I started a band. I'm touring. And I sold a book. In addition to, like, other weird stuff. But then you get a guy from India write you and be like, are you ever going to act again? And you're like, kill me now. Kill me now. like, what am I supposed to... I'm sorry that you didn't see Mercy Street or Rise. You can watch them on Hulu. Right. Like, I don't know what to tell you. I'm not on that show right now. But I also feel like I might be happier right now. I'm certainly happier than I was then.
Yes.
So it's like this trade-off of, like... I don't know.
Well, this is something that we are constantly talking about. There's a yogic term called dharma.
Sure.
And dharma is being in harmony with the divine order of the cosmos.
Yeah.
Which is whatever the order of the cosmos, you were created for a purpose, for a dharma. For there was a puzzle that is this universe, and you're the piece that is here to do whatever your piece is here to do. And it may be popular, and it may be not popular, and it may be planting a garden, and it may be setting a table, and it may be creating a movie, and it may be doing whatever. And it's, can I surrender and be in acceptance and in listening to whatever my personal dharma is outside of what popular opinion or what makes money or whatever those things that I'm conditioned to think are important are? Because at the end of the day, it's about fulfillment.
Yeah.
And what is going to fulfill us isn't necessarily what is going to make other people happy or what is going to make a lot of money.
And there's also, you can distinguish between fulfillment and happiness or meaning and happiness. Like, I read this really cool book called The Power of Meaning by, I think, Emily Esfahani Smith is her name. And they did these studies that people in highly developed countries with, like, you know, booming economies report very high levels of happiness and very low levels of meaning. Did I tell you this?
Yes.
I might have told you this. And people in developing countries, much less robust economies, report very high levels of meaning and very low levels of happiness. However, the rates of addiction and suicide are so much worse in the developed countries with higher levels of happiness and lower levels of meaning. And her whole thesis is around this idea that, like, we're actually looking for meaning. Mm. That's what keeps us going. You know, like, how many parents, you know, once they have a child are like, now I know why I'm here. I'm here to make this world a better world for my child or keep my child safe. Like, it automatically grants you meaning, you know? And I find sometimes that certain things in our culture that are held up as like, this is, I'm like, I would feel empty on that. That doesn't have meaning for me. It doesn't move my needle. You know, it doesn't push what I'm doing forward. So, I think, I'm always asking myself that kind of dharmic question. And then there are certain things that are karmic. Like, part of How I Met Your Mother felt both karmic and dharmic. Yes. I was like, I gotta do this. I'm locked into this contract. I clearly have some karma with all these people and with a role like this and everything. That's where, you know, as actors, you really get that, like, you can't do anything to screw up your dharmic destiny. If a role is meant for you, you're getting it. And if its role is not meant for you, you cannot bang down that door. It's not going to happen. The ones that happen are, you probably know this from casting so much, like, it's just so easy to cast them. When the right person comes in, it's like, just come out to lunch, you know?
Yes, I mean, I've had times where actually there was an actor I knew who was coming in who I kind of like wanted to get the role because I liked them and I knew they were talented. And they came in and they did a good job. And then someone came in after them that just wasn't.
Yeah.
And it was like, all of heaven knew this person was born to do this role. And you're like, it's undeniable.
I had this part that I cut. I ended up cutting it. I shot it and cut it from the movie because the liberal arts was too long. But Jesse, my character, had this friend back in New York, and his friend was kept saying he was moving to Spain. That was like his big thing. But he kept throwing himself going away parties. Like, he wouldn't move. And things kept happening. There was a passport problem. It was like his fifth going away party. And finally he's like, so we'll go to Spain. You know, it was actually my favorite line in the whole script that I cut, where he was like, my character was like, go to Spain. And he's like, I can't go. And he says, why? He goes, I'm scared. He goes, what are you scared of? He says, what if people aren't nice to me? And the line was, you're going to Spain. You're not going to France, dude. You're going to Spain. There you go, with your French boyfriend.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
So I ended up cutting the whole thing. But there was this guy who came in who was a big working actor. Like, I'd seen him and stuff. I knew him a little bit socially. And he was so good. And he finished. And I said, can I tell you why you're not getting this role? Like, right after he finished. And his face, like, dropped. And he was like, why? And I said, I believe you would go to Spain. Like, you seem like the kind of guy who would go to Spain. I need to find the guy who will not go to Spain. I need to find a guy whose spine isn't as strong as yours, you know? And it's essence, right?
Essence.
It's essence. It's DNA.
Always casting essence. That's what you're looking for. It's like, what's that essence match?
Yeah.
And your soul won't lie to you. And I have this thing in casting. Like, I won't fight anymore during casting, in early rounds of casting. Like, I just feel like the person will sit back and go, we'll see.
Yeah.
Like, we'll see. Because I always know that when you get to the final round of casting,
it will be clear.
I never need to say anything. It's so clear in the room that the whole room says it.
Yeah.
That my job is, like, almost just to hold the space until the whole room says it.
And also for actors going into the room, you know, like, I'm an actor and I coach actors and I work with a lot of actors. And there's always this thing of, like, how can I be what they want? And I'm like, you can't.
You cannot.
You can be what you are, and that's the only option. So,
and the more you become, the more they want you, because they're looking for someone who's alive and vibrant and interesting.
Right, and either they'll say, you are the right fit for this vision, or you aren't, but you are amazing.
You know, it was hard, like, coming from NYU, like, my triumph at NYU, and I'm not kidding, and you can ask anyone there in the late 90s, was I crushed the grandfather in Awake and Sing. Like, the old communist grandfather. And you know, I was like 24, right? Shuffling around like a 72-year-old. And it's like, but that's great, because someone's got to play the role. And like, I'm going to play the old Jew. I got an old Jew in me, an old Jewish barber communist. And it was like it was like amazing, right? But then I get out of school, and a couple years later, I'm playing Ralphie the grandson in Awake and Sing, because that's the role that I was right for at the time. And there's this thing where I'm always wanting to be more of a character actor than they let me be. But it's not true, because I've actually gotten to play some weird, interesting roles. But something people will not let me do is be a villain. And I want to play one, and there was a guest spot years ago on some big, I don't know, hour-long show, but it was like, this guy had done something so horrible, like unforgivably horrible, I can't remember what it was, but it was like really violating and awful, and the feedback I got, the casting director who I knew was just like, oh, no one in the room believed you would do that. Like, literally no one believed I would do that, which is, like, a great compliment to my, the virtue that
it's great
I...
for life.
Yeah, for life. But, you know, there's... I mean, there's a reason... And I'm sure he's a nice guy, but, like, Michael Shannon can play those roles because you're like, that guy would do anything, you know?
Yes.
And that's just the essence he gives off, you know?
Yes.
And I sometimes feel a little trapped where I'm like, why do I have to play virtue, the virtuous one? But I also, I actually care about that stuff. And I think I've lived it enough that it kind of, my eyes tell a story.
Yeah, that's
you know?
It. Well, there's that thing that happens as a director, too. I had a producer tell me the other day, they're like, oh, well, when I think about shows that are joyous, like, that's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I'm like, you do joy. And I'm like, I do joy. Like, there's a part of me that's like, I also do other things.
Yeah.
But there's an essence thing that it's not just actors that get into that
Type kind of thing. I find that I immediately recoil when anyone tells me I'm anything.
Yes.
Like when someone's like, well, first of all, if they're like, you look tired, I'm like, I'm going to throttle you. But if they tell me like, you're a funny guy, it's like, not always. Or like, you're pretty serious, aren't you? It's like, not always. Like there seems to be this resistance to granting us our complications.
Right.
And our edges and our ability to be lots of different things.
Yes.
You know?
Right. Well, that's one of the reasons, you know, our listeners don't know this, but our mutual friend Maddie's show, right? Like, for me to be directing that, it's like, there, and yes, this too, right?
Yeah.
Here's something that's much more complicated.
Yeah.
And much more gray.
And what's required in our world right now is for us to accept the gradations that we are, accept it in each other, accept that sometimes it's hard for me to say what I want to say, and also accept if I finally say it, accept your reaction to it, and it may not be what I want, but we have to accept the humanity as it shows up in real time.
Yeah.
And there's a resistance to that because we'd rather put things in boxes.
It's also easier from a media perspective. It's like very, they want boxes. They want simple stories. And I find that when someone does like a profile on me, it's such a relief. So, like this, this woman from the New York Times when I was doing the Babylon Line, did such a lovely profile. And I felt like that we had like a 4-hour conversation at the Rubin Museum. And I read it and I was like, she captured what we were talking about. And it was like all over the place, but it was like it honored what we were talking about. And it wasn't like, how I met Josh, you know, like I mean, kill me now. Like, how many puns can we make about the show that I did all those years ago? And, we almost have to fight for our complexity, like our right to be complex.
Well, I love that. We have to fight for our complexity. I'm so curious, just on the note of your spiritual journey, you talked about there was a time you started going to South America and going on these ayahuasca journeys. And I'm curious about how that exploration into the spiritual side of who you are, how that influenced your work or influenced the kind of art you wanted to create.
Well, I think it made me braver, like in just kind of a blanket way, like a baseline way. I felt like I had to confront and stare at some things that were really unpleasant. I had to get like more, I had to get comfortable with discomfort, which is like kind of what you're doing in drama school. I suffered a little bit more in life. I think life, like that kind of curriculum idea, just tenderizes you. Like I was talking to Jesse Pennington, one of my classmates who played Dr. Astaroff in this production. And I had done Uncle Vanya at school, and there's just something about like when you get older and you understand Chekhov because you understand suffering and you understand longing and you understand regret, like all these things that Chekhov is about. And when you're 20 or 24, like you haven't been dinged up enough by life. So ayahuasca for me, and I did a lot of ceremonies, but it was about doing like an honest deep dive into my psyche and like kind of seeing what was there. It was like absolute exploration, Jungian shadow work, like just, and I felt more loved than I'd ever felt, more unconditionally loved, and more like I started rewriting a lot of the God script through that, because I would you know, be thinking, oh, I've been misbehaving, whatever that means, you know, and I thought, oh, I'm gonna get punished in the ceremony, and I was never met with anything but love. You know, Richard Rohr says this great thing. He says, all truly prayerful people, like saints and guru, like all people who gave up everything to find God, when they contact that, everyone comes back reporting that they met a lover, not a dictator. Mm-hmm. Like everyone. No one's like, you guys, we're in trouble. Like I just truly contacted God and pissed,
right,
you know,
right.
That's never what it is. Like, it's foundationally loving, and we're, that's where it's manifest out of. Now, I can't explain evil on this podcast right now. Like, I need some more time to work out what that is and where that comes
from.
Will
you come back when you have that?
I'll come back. Yeah. I'll write the paper and just read it. I'll just read the.
So excited about that.
But
it'll be a fun night.
You know, I do, it let me, it sometimes would bust me up as an artist. Like, I could shake out some narrative cobwebs that I couldn't figure out, like, in a very practical way.
Sure.
But ultimately, it just left me really sincere. Like, after an ayahuasca ceremony, like, the last thing you want to be is sarcastic. Like, I was so... I value sincerity, and I like it when people say what they mean. And I've always been... I used to be much more sarcastic, but when I'm met with sarcasm now, I'm always like... It really throws me. I'm like... Wait, you're saying the opposite of what you mean.
Mm.
Why are you doing that? You know, and I can read it. I speak that language, but I'm also like, I just don't like talking that way anymore. So it kind of met my sincerity. It brought it forward more, and it allowed me to just be like, okay with being like a feeling person.
Mm-hmm.
I at a certain point, I think I haven't done it for quite a while, and I think I knew what my homework was. And it'll show you what needs to be done. You know, one of the great things is, like, sometimes you go in and you're like locked in a grievance with someone. You're like, and you can't see their side of the story. And it just shows you their side of the story. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, that's what they're thinking. And then you, from that place, forgiveness can be granted and accepted. You know, so sometimes for those things, that's why I always tell people, you know, who first drink it, like, you're probably going to think that every politician needs to drink it, because it's an anti-conflict kind of experience where you just want to heal and you just want to help, because it's like returns you to your factory settings, which is what I think we are anyway. Like the solution to everything is service.
Yeah.
Like, get out of yourself, you know, turn outward, like, serve. And it just reminds you of that so dramatically.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. The yogis talk about, like, the purpose of our suffering is to lead us from suffering.
Yeah.
Because when we understand suffering, we understand empathy. When we understand empathy, we get into service. And also that our real only affliction is illusion.
Right.
And so the truth really does set us free.
And also, without suffering, we'd have no reason to change. Like, literally no reason to change.
It's the catalyst.
Yeah. I was also thinking recently about empathy, how certainly we have an empathy deficit in our culture. You know, there's that great James Baldwin quote about people won't give up their anger because they'll be forced to deal with pain.
Mm.
And if you're asking someone to be more empathetic, this just occurred to me the other day, you're actually saying, we need you to take on more pain.
Mm.
We need you to open your heart and take on other people's pain. We need you to expand your circle of compassion beyond your tribe, beyond your family, and see that there are people that are suffering. But that's a big ask. If it's not your natural bent and you think, like, no, I'm just going to worry about the people that look like me or the people that have my last name or whatever, go to my church. There's a kind of pain in... Well, awakening is painful. Jung said that. There's no coming to consciousness without pain.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I mean, we've had that in our own lives where we've had moments where we looked at each other and went, oh my gosh, sleeping was so much easier.
Yeah.
But this is so much more what this is about, that this is. And, you know, Lin-Manuel had said that that's why all artists, our only call is empathy. Because as the artists and the healers, if we can all just take a stand for empathy in our work, empathy in our art, empathy in what we're creating, then we create the change in the world.
And I think that's why... And not to hijack this, and I hesitate to even say his name, but I think the reason that our president is so infuriating to artists is because it's like it's a man without, who's seemingly without empathy. Like, I mean, did you see his tweet about the Malibu fire? You know what I mean? The California fire is just like, oh my God, oh my God. Like it's like having an abusive father in the house, like a raging alcoholic abusive father.
And it's about separatism, right? Because if this was a red state, only, I'm sure the conversation in the tweets would be different, right? It's about let's take sides.
But that you know, when I read someone said like how important story is, like, how many stories and artists can you talk about from 200 years ago versus how many politicians' names do you know from 200 years ago? Like, the politician, it's what, Rob, I love that distinction between treble and bass. You know, he talks about, like, too much treble, we need a little bass. Like, politics is treble. It's just treble. And bass is, like, the artists are trying to create the bass.
Yeah.
You know? Bring us back to like perennial truths. Speaking of Dharma, I had an astrologer years ago. My friend got me a reading from this woman in Wyoming. She didn't know who I was. She just had my first name and my birth, you know, information. And she got a lot of like storyteller, teacher, leader, was all really writer, was really coming through for her. And she said, I'm really getting very clear that your Dharma is to make the old stories new again. And I just love that as a like succinct idea. Like, what are the, like the old stories? There's only like 17 plots, right? Like, what are the old stories that need to be dusted off and refreshed for our time, for modern years? I really took that as like a great thing.
Well, you know, our listeners know I've been deep in Joseph Campbell lately, who talks a lot about when art is... art that is didactic is telling you what to do, but art that is transcendent takes what is like the universal laws, what is the thing that lifts us up, and translates it through art.
Yeah.
And so what we are all searching for is rapture in our art, which is the thing that lifts our human spirit. And that's the thing that I think is the old stories, the ancient wisdom, the universal truths, retold in new ways, have the ability to lift us up and help us re-remember who we are.
Right, and that's the I think the key is, one of the things about ayahuasca that was so powerful for me is I would have these revelations that didn't feel like new information, they would feel like recovered information. Like I remembered something, and it was something elemental and essential about humanity that was like, it was the Adam and Eve in me.
Yes.
Like, it was like the primordial, this is how I am stamped, this is my factory settings, like, this is who I am. And I'm lost in the dark wood of the modern world in my life. And it reminds me, like, no, you're, that's, none of that is, it's like a parent. You know, you wake up from a nightmare, like, it's okay. That's what I got from it, you know? Remembrance, you know, put the body back together, you know, sew it back together. The separation into unity, that's like the only journey.
Well, isn't that like the most exciting thing about like the spiritual awakening is to go, oh, here I am really. Like there's this deeper part of me that's always been in me since I was a child that's now reintegrating into my life.
Yeah.
And as it comes to the surface, the thrilling thing is to know the part of me that always was and feels
right.
Like it's been timeless.
Right. And that's why, like, the abuse of children or trauma that we go through that dissociates us, you know, dismembers us, is so grievous. Like, to harm someone who, like, I can see this in my youngest niece. Like, she still has that. She just has the flicker of the thing still, you know, and we all lose it because we all have to go through junior high.
Yeah.
You know, like that's what it'll extinguish it for a while, and you'll start thinking, you know, on some level you make the argument like all of life is a recovery from the ages 12 to 15. Like you have to heal what happened to you between the ages of 12 and 15 to have something of a shot, you know, and, it's those that first moments of self-consciousness. By the way, are you guys watching Big Mouth on Netflix? Have you seen it?
No.
It's this cartoon. It's hilarious and filthy, but it's all about these kids going through puberty. And there's a... what made me think about this was... there's this episode where two of the characters, the kids, they eat these gummy... pot gummy bears. And the kid, Nick, he freaks out, and he's taken to, like, what's called the alone zone. And it's just, he's having, like, a bad trip. And older Nick shows him around his house. He's like, you're very successful at comedy. And he's like, oh, my God, this pad is amazing. And he's like, yeah. And he goes, am I happy? He goes, well, you want to do more dramatic stuff. And he's like, why? And he goes, who knows? It's just an ego thing. You know? And then he's like, do I have a wife and children? He's like, no, because they have needs. And it's just like devastating. But the whole show is just hilarious and poignant and amazing.
Right, yeah. Right. And poignant in a way where you're not expecting. And then you're it is.
Exactly.
It really
gets me.
You mentioned something earlier about it's a daily practice.
Yeah.
How do you take these things that you're learning, integrating, incorporating into your life, you know, that could come through a ceremony, that could come through a conversation, that could come through a great book you read? How do you keep it alive for you in your daily life?
Well, I think one of the things that's important to remember, hilariously, given what I'm about to say, is that we are all prone to spiritual amnesia. Mm. So, like, I have been on the mountaintop, literal mountaintops, with, like, I figured it out. Mm. I figured it out. I know what this is. I know what the drill is. I know why I'm here. I know how to move forward with minimal friction. And then it will go away, often fast. And I'll be like, oh my God, how did I get here? Like, how am I not really in the brothel, but, like, how am I in the brothel all of a sudden? You know what I mean? Like, how am I? I've had not a good few days, you know, and it's not, I'll be able to find myself again, but to remember that it's a process of remembering and forgetting, 2 steps forward, 1 step back, 5 steps back, 2 steps forward. Like, it's, you know, if we were done with the struggle, we would die. So it's like, we're here, we're in a body, the body's aging. Like, I mean, it's intense. It's intense to be alive. It's intense to have a body that needs to be fed all the time. As I was thinking about that, I'm like, feeding again? Like, this thing is so needy, this body of mine.
It's decaying, no matter what I do.
But I have to move around. I have to pay someone to tell me to move around and jump.
There's so many needs. That, like, you have to feed it. You have to move it. You have to wash it. It has to earn money.
It wants to be up close and inside another body. What is this? It's so,
so
weird. If you really break it down, it is super weird. Like, sometimes I'm like, wait, I'm still that Josh Radnor character that I was, like, 30 years ago as a kid. Like, I'm still that guy?
Right.
It feels like it's been on so long. Like, I should be another person by now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I find the basic weirdness of being human to be never... It's like the fact that I have a hand that knows that this is a hand on a body that's a larger body. And it sounds like I took a lot of acid before I came over here. But, you know, just the basic fundamental weirdness mixed with... But there's a point and purpose to this, you know? My favorite quote, probably, I talked about this on Rob's podcast, but Al-Ghazali, this Sufi mystic, said, "No, O beloved, man was not created in jest or at random, but marvelously made and for some great end."
Mm.
You know, and I always think about, okay, there's got to be a, there's a thing. There's a, this, Terrence McKenna says, the thing to understand is that we are trapped in a very elaborate work of art.
Yeah.
You know, that some artist is doing something unbelievably complicated with, but for us to make our way through the art is very simple, but it's like finding the simplicity within the complication. So I have had to make peace with suffering. I've had to make peace with failure daily. I've had to make peace with criticism. I've had to make peace with people not responding the way I want, both to my art and to me as a person. All these things that I've had to, like, cede control around, and also not call necessarily bad, but let them grow me rather than destroy me. And, like, I just think that being an artist and being a human is just, like, a parade of failures.
Yeah.
It's just like nothing but failure. The trick, though, is, okay, what did I learn from my latest failure that I'm going to bring into the new thing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you get great artists who just, failure doesn't seem to bother them. You know, you like direct, like, an older actor who's just so good, and you're like, what are you even doing? You're not doing anything. You're just mumbling your lines, and I can't take my eyes off you.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't care anymore.
Yep.
They don't care about impressing you anymore.
Mm.
And when we're dancing for someone real fast, you know, when someone's trying to really impress you, it's like, mm-hmm. back up a few feet. But I'm it's just been a process of like trying to let go of thinking that it should be another way.
Yeah. Oh, that's yeah, everything.
That's
you
everything. Know,
accepting everything as it is.
Yeah.
And allowing this moment to be and knowing that is our perfect teacher.
And that it's going to change because that's the only law of the universe.
Yeah, it passes. It
yeah. Everything passes.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's so interesting because when I first kind of found out about you, because I had seen your work on TV, but I kind of didn't put two and two together, but I heard you on Rob's podcast, uh-huh. and that was when I first really felt connected to who is this guy? This is like an incredible voice. This is an incredible vision and what he's saying. And I remember you sharing a quote. I think it was the podcast you did about the quotes.
The quoting, yeah, yeah.
And there was a quote that you shared, and I loved it so much I actually put it on my wall, because at the time I was going through a complete identity crisis. I'd chopped all my hair off. I sort of left acting. It was just like an unhealthy, abusive relationship, right?
Yeah,
sometimes
yeah.
we get in. And I was going through a divorce.
Yeah.
And you shared this quote, and I'll butcher it so you can say it in the proper
sure.
way.
Sure.
Something to do with, if I fall, let me fall.
Oh, the one I am becoming will catch me.
That's the one.
Yeah.
And I heard you speak that. I looked it up. I Googled it. I found it.
Yeah.
I put it on my wall. And I must have read that to myself, looking in the mirror at my own eyes
yeah.
every day.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so happy.
For so long.
Yeah.
And so it's what is amazing to me is that all of us have no idea the impact we have on other people.
Yeah.
We have no idea if the work you do on a TV show or a quote you share on your friend's podcast,
yeah.
or a conversation you have in a bar, or a show that you see,
yeah.
and someone doesn't even know you saw them perform in
mm-hmm.
it. But we all, as artists, have this power to use our voice and our perspective and our pain and our stories to impact people, and we have no idea how far that impact can go.
Yeah.
And that's a gift.
Yeah.
And so there's a gift in showing up to our own pain. There's a gift in showing up to our own process that we must never take for granted. So I thank you for that.
Yeah, oh, that's so great to hear. That, weirdly, I think I hear from people about that particular quote more than any other quote. That seemed to be like the money quote for a lot of people. But that quote was given to me, I think, at the 8th Street subway station. My friend Allie, I was in a breakup. I was just in a spin about this breakup. And she wrote the most beautiful thing. And then she just wrote a quote. She said, "Let me fall. If I must fall, the one I am becoming will catch me." And I had to look it up because I was like, who said that? But I remember feeling like almost like the quote itself caught me.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was
yeah.
just like,
yeah.
oh.
Yeah.
Like, and also this notion that there are different us's
mm-hmm.
In yeah. operation. There's the me, the protagonist going through the experience and suffering. But then there's this older, wiser me that's like, I got you.
Uh-huh.
I had this crazy thing happen to me last month where I woke up in the middle of the night and I must have been having a bad dream. And I was like, my heart was racing and it was like a panic attack. And I popped up, like bolted upright. And I was like, like breathing heavily. And I immediately put my hand on my heart and I went, shh, 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 it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay. You're okay. You're okay. You're okay. You're okay. And then I got myself back to sleep. And it was like 60 seconds total. But I remembered it because I was like, wait, that was me scared, but it was also me comforting me.
Yes.
But they're different. Like, who was doing what to who?
Yes.
And the different, the levels of, like, the comforter or the parent or the loving, the love is, like, untouched by the fear.
Yes.
It's untouched by the stress and the anxiety. It's just, like, it's the witness.
Yeah.
You know?
That, for me, is an example of how quantum entanglement works, right? Like, quantum entanglement says, like, once you're energetically connected to something, you're never unconnected from it.
Uh-huh.
So it's like my past self and my future self is connected to myself, and at any time they can come in and do what they
right,
need to do.
Right, right, right,
right. Like, yeah. You know, one of my favorite meditations to do, and especially was really helpful to me in my 20s and my early 30s, is I would always have my older self come to me then and hold me.
Mm.
And would just hold me when I was crying. But I remember this one specific breakup I was having, and I was going, it was 10 years ago, and I was in this breakup where I was just in all this pain, and I was going from New York to LA, and on this plane ride, and I remember I was like in this front seat of this airplane and I was in pain and I could see my older self and his older self like sitting in front of me in this airplane, and that both of them like took my hands and were like, it's all okay. We're okay. You're okay. we're all okay. As if, like, there was, like, a, that quantum entanglement, that, like, time travel mentality of there are different us's and they're all coexisting right now.
Yeah.
And it's all okay. Like, you can breathe into the fact that this will pass and there's a part of you that's already passed through it.
Right, right. And, yeah. Did you ever see that Burning Man statue of, like, the inner child?
Oh, yes.
Oh.
For listeners, just Google Burning Man inner child statue or whatever. But, it, you know, the two people who are like,
yeah.
And the little inner children are like, yeah, that killed me.
If only I could remember that in the perfect moment to remember that.
Yeah, yeah,
like
yeah.
When you're in the crossed arms moment.
Yeah. There's also like a weird negotiation between like, I actually have realized that I don't want to be a yogi on a mountaintop. Mm. Like I'm a householder, like I'm in the world. There's a part of me that like, I still want to celebrate when good things happen.
Yeah.
I don't want to be so, I don't want to have so much equanimity that like, I can't celebrate or I can't grieve or
yeah.
Like I still there's and I don't it's not even like oh I'm so dramatic because I'm fairly not dramatic but I still want to delight in things.
You want the human experience.
I want the human experience and I still want my heart to break at things that are
well there's
sad,
something interesting
you know?
That the yogis say the word guru is like the one who brings the light
right
and the guru is like the one who's on the mountaintop like the Eckhart Tolle's like the one who come in knowing so they're like hey I've been through spiritual purification here's the way to go
right?
But then there's something else called the acharya
mm-hmm.
and they always say if you have to pick a teacher, pick an acharya, not a guru, because the acharya is the one who's in the mud with you.
Oh.
And the acharya is kind of like if you and I were walking on a mountain path and I was just 1 foot in front of you and I trip on a rock and I turn around and say, hey, watch that rock.
Uh-huh.
We're on this path together.
Right.
And so we're still in our humanness. We're not sitting up on the mountaintop having comments on what this life is.
Yeah.
We're walking the path and stumbling on the rocks
yeah.
and feeling those feelings and continuing to elevate in whatever way we can.
Right. And that's why I think like things like 12 step where it's like, the people who have been in suffering, years ago, I went on a meditation retreat with my meditation teacher, and the theme of the weekend was addiction. And he started following the Maharishi when he was like 16, and he'd never had a sip of alcohol. And I just couldn't bear this weekend. I didn't think he had anything interesting to say about addiction. And I'm like, get me a sober heroin addict to talk
yes.
about addiction. Like, that's who I want to hear about it from. Like, who has met the darkness and survived? Like,
yeah.
tell me about what didn't kill you.
Yeah.
And I just felt like he didn't have that to share. He hadn't earned it.
Yeah.
You know? So I think that's a little more what you're talking
yeah.
about. Like, yeah, I love that metaphor of, like, there's a stone up there.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, real quick, I want to talk about your music before we finish.
Sure.
Because I'm slightly obsessed. One of the reasons I'm obsessed, and as you know, I had the experience of, like, one morning I was, like, journaling, and I was just, like, listening to, like, a music playlist, and I heard the song, and, it, like, I was journaling, and you, when you hear exactly the right phrase for exactly the right thing you're journaling about,
yeah.
and I was like, who is talking to me through this playlist, and I had to go look, and it was, like, Radner and Lee.
I love it.
And I was like, okay, and, but what I really love is when an artist, here you are, an actor who was brave enough to also write, who was brave enough to also direct, who's brave enough to also write music and then perform music and play the guitar in front of people. And I think a lot of people might be curious or interested in doing things in other mediums,
yeah.
but are so afraid of the potential of failing or going through the novice part of learning a new
yeah.
medium or,
yeah.
or practicing in a new medium. And I'm just so curious about like, what in you said this? I'm going to do this. This is a pull for me.
Uh-huh. You mean with music specifically?
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
yeah. Well, I've been an obsessive music fan, like obsessive. And I thought that people who could play instruments and write songs, I thought it was like a superpower that I didn't have.
Yeah.
And when I was going through that breakup, the one where I got that quote from my friend, I wrote a breakup song, like I just, and I had a guitar and I knew like three chords, but I didn't know how to strum. So I wrote this all variations on a D chord and I was like flamenco strumming, like just literally just hitting I didn't know how to strum. But Ben really liked the song, and I started playing it at shows, and people were really moved by it. And then one day he was like, let's be a two-guitar band. Let's just be a two-guitar band. So then I was like, good. So we started playing, and I started obsessively writing songs on my own, some of which turned into Radner and Lee songs on the second record, were just things that I brought him, like a melody riff or something on. And I learned that I could write songs. Now, I will say that, like, throughout my life, I've always, like, hummed or sung made-up songs in the shower. And I'm like, oh, that's kind of a good tune, but I never thought about it. But the very first Radner and Lee song we wrote was a song called Wider Spaces, which is the last song on the first record. And Ben said to me, do you have any melodies that have been kicking around in your head? And when I was doing Disgraced, I woke up from a dream, and there was a children's choir in my dream that was singing this melody, and it was so beautiful, and everyone was crying, and the melody was so strong in my head that I, like, croaked it into a voice memo on my iPhone. And so this is, like, maybe 6 or 7 months later. He goes, do you have any melodies? And I was like, wait a minute. I do. I dreamt this melody. And so I listened to it, and I started humming it to Ben. He started playing it on guitar. He's like, ooh, I love that. And that's our first song, Wider Spaces, which is a melody from my dream. So I just have always found this. And Ben, who I got involved in my ayahuasca world, but he, after a ceremony, he was like, the medicine told me that I'm supposed to support your musical vision. And it was just this thing where he was like, I'm supposed to support. And he's been unbelievable as, like, a songwriting mentor and a guitar teacher when I need it. And we're, like, fully a two-guitar band now, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm holding down rhythm, and he's doing really more interesting stuff because we have two guitars. We can make a different sound. Mm-hmm. I wrote about this for Thrive, and can I tell your listeners about my newsletter?
Please.
Yeah, this is just like a monthly or bi-monthly thing that I do, like an essay. Kind of, if you dig this conversation, you'll dig the newsletter, and I suggest a lot of things and let you know what I'm up to if you're curious. But I've been writing for Arianna Huffington's site, Thrive. But I wrote about becoming a musician in my 40s, that when I was at Sundance, Robert Redford talked about this notion of starting from zero, where it's like you're at the top of your game, like you've got to start from zero. You've got to make yourself a novice again. And the benefits of this are, they have to triumph over the terror because there's so much terror. But the benefit is that I found is making yourself a novice. Like when you're a little kid, you're bad at everything. Mm-hmm. So you're just trying it. You're much more playful, experimental mode. When you get older, especially if you've been rewarded for something you're good at, you tend to stay in your lane. Mm-hmm. But I found that learning how to play guitar, one, I didn't have anything to say when I was 15. Like I didn't have anything to write about. Now I have some stuff to write about. Secondly, learning how to do something new gives you such a feeling of excitement, like triumph, like learning bar chords when you couldn't play them and suddenly you can, and getting a different strumming pattern and all these things. It actually weirdly makes you feel younger. You know, you feel like, oh my God, I can do. Film directing felt the same way to me. Like when you discover that you have a new skill, you expand.
Yes.
You're like, oh my God, I have more skills. I have more ways to tell stories. And also, the music feels like it's in the tradition of what I've been doing, which is storytelling.
Yes.
Sometimes I do a 90-minute movie. Sometimes I do a 90-minute story. Sometimes I do a 3-minute story set to music.
That's right.
It's still storytelling. Feels like the same thing. But it's the thing that's giving me the most joy at the moment, you know. And if you said to me, like, do you want to see a movie or do you want to see some live music, I'd always be like, let's see some live music, you know. Like, it's just more exciting to me than the other stuff. Again, don't tell my agents.
They are never gonna hear this.
Yeah.
Do you want to do a little speed round?
Okay. You guys have speed rounds?
Well, I'm just gonna make it up on the spot. That's what my muse said.
Okay.
What is your favorite thing about being an artist?
Connection.
What is your favorite food?
I like Italian food, I guess.
What's your favorite thing about romantic love?
Connection.
If you could tell any artist who's at the beginning novice stage of their exploration any advice or wisdom, what would that be?
There's that phrase, you know, what's in the way is the way. Like, just, like, travel into the eye of the storm.
What is most misunderstood about you?
that people would think that I was the character I played on How I Met Your Mother.
What do you tell yourself every day?
It's okay.
What do you love the most about life?
Connection.
And so it is.
Uh-huh. Three out of eight answers were the same.
Yeah, that's right. Connection.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, that's the name of the game.
Yeah. Thank you for connecting with us.
Oh my God. You guys are great.
Such and a pleasure.
And thank you for using your work to connect with us.
Yeah. And thanks for providing a forum to have these conversations. It's really cool. And I love just getting to have these conversations on the record.
Yeah.
You know, we could very well have this conversation and it'll just be the three of us, but it's also cool to have people listen in.
Yeah. If our listeners fall in love with you and they want to find your newsletter, they want to find you, they want to connect with your music, how do they do those things?
Well, Radner and Lee is available wherever fine music is streamed or bought. I'm recording a solo album. I don't know if it's going to be called Josh Radner, if I'm going to get a cool Bon Iver, Tallest Man on Earth kind of name. I'm not sure.
You'll let us know.
I'll let you guys know. You can sign up for the newsletters on either my Instagram page or my Twitter page in the bio. There's the sign up.
That's how I did it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Are you on? I'll throw you on.
I'm so not on.
Okay, okay.
I can't wait to be on.
I'll put you on.
I was just playing hard to get.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't want to come on.
You wanted me to say directly.
I wanted you to come to me.
Yeah.
I had to go look him up.
Josh, you're such a delight. It's been so amazing.
So nice talking to you guys.
Thank you. You are our soul brother. And we can't wait till you are back for another conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe the next time we'll talk about romantic love and what it's here to teach us. Part two.
Okay.
Thank you so much for listening. We love to feel like we have friends all over the world in you who are committed to doing their dream on the planet.
And if you liked this podcast and you want to find out more about what we're doing or who we are, our pop-up classes, our online classes, you can check all of that out at thecreateseries.com.
And if you want to be part of our Facebook community, you can go to the Create Community page. That's C.R.E.A.T.Community.
And if you loved this podcast, why not share it with a friend?